So my trip in Little Rock actually intersects in some ways the themes of our race and class section. So let me just share with you what this was all about. In the U.S., until the end of, well, during the year of segregation, there were a series of institutions created, many of them during Reconstruction, you know, in the 1870s especially, and 80s, but it continued. Some of them public, so some state systems have had historically black institutions. Jackson State is a black university that's part of the University of Mississippi system. Others are private institutions. Xavier College in New Orleans is a Catholic liberal arts college that's an historically black college. Philander Smith in Little Rock was founded by United Methodists, which is a progressive, social justice-oriented Christian denomination, founded in 1877. Like many, maybe like all of these institutions, they face very deep challenges in the 21st century. So we're 50 years post-desegregation. Legal segregation ended in the 1960s. It persisted in various ways, but basically the legal aspects of segregation are gone. And many people question the need or even the desirability of having black-oriented, African-American-oriented colleges and universities. Now, none of these are exclusively African-American. They all welcome non-African-American students. But Philander Smith, for example, is 95% black. It has a couple of Latino. It has some foreign students of African extraction from Haiti and from the Caribbean. They have a few. The guy I hung out with there said occasionally they'll get an exchange student for a semester from a white college who will come there. But it's a black institution. And the question is, what's the point at this point? Now, the answer to that question is both relevant to recruiting students, and it's, of course, an added burden on these institutions if they only get students who can't go anywhere else, right? So if it's really just academically extremely challenged students, then that doesn't make for a very healthy university environment. But it's equally a problem for donors. I mean, liberal arts colleges depend heavily upon donations, on endowments. And do wealthy donors oriented towards African-American education and the condition of race in the United States, do they want to contribute scholarship funds to the University of Wisconsin, let's say, or the University of Arkansas in the case of Arkansas, to increase the economic support for African-American students there, or do they want to support historically black colleges and universities? So it's clearly a problem that they face. So Philander Smith has decided they had this serious sort of rethinking of what their mission was, and decided that by dedicating the college to social justice as a central concern, not just as a kind of service learning face of it, although that's part of it, but as really their mission statement. The mission, I think I might have mentioned this last time, the mission says more or less, the mission of Philander Smith's college is to produce academically accomplished graduates grounded as advocates for social justice, determined to change the world for the better. That's a pretty extraordinary mission statement. So lots of mission statements for universities contain things like citizenship or social responsibility in a list, but not, I don't know, any other place that has placed it at the center. So their hope is, on the one hand, this is an affirmation of values that were there anyway, so it's not as if it's just a branding question that they've decided, this will be a good marketing ploy. So it's an affirmation of values that were there, but their hope is that it will create a mission that actually has traction, that will both attract certain kinds of students who would find that a worthwhile thing, and in the long term might even allow for it to become a more integrated institution. You know, so if it really establishes itself as a liberal arts college interfacing with activism and social justice, and develops a serious academic program connected, in which that's a theme running throughout the curriculum, well, then perhaps over time it could become an institution that would attract more than just African-American students from the South. I had never been to a historically black college before. I did a seminar there, about half faculty and half students. There was one white faculty member, and everyone else was African-American in the room, about 15 people. You know, I have given talks in South Africa that had that racial composition, but certainly never in an American institution. And it was very, interesting for me. I'm not sure all of you know, most of the American students here should know that Little Rock played a really crucial role in the desegregation struggles. In 1957, Central High School in Little Rock was desegregated by court order, and 9 black students in September of 1957 entered Central High School. The governor, Governor Faubus at the time, sent out the state National Guard, the Arkansas National Guard, to prevent this desegregation of the school. And Eisenhower then was basically forced, because they were defying the Supreme Court, to send the 101st Airborne Division to Little Rock to enforce the desegregation. And there are these scenes, they're some of the most potent, iconic scenes of the civil rights era, of armed soldiers, with guns and bayonets, just with guns, escorting these 9 young 15 and 16-year-old African-Americans through crowds that are just jeering and haunting, just filled with anger and rage in their faces, to Central High School. At Central High School, under the Clinton administration, was named a National Historical Monument. It's a gigantic school. It has 5,000 students in it. Just an incredibly beautiful building. Apparently has become a very distinguished high school, very integrated in Little Rock. It's the sort of the top high school in the state, one of the better high schools in the country. But it's in the middle of a national park now, with a museum of civil rights adjoining it, which was fantastic, a really interesting museum to visit. When I went to Philander Smith, I spent about 3 hours there at the beginning of the talk, I was telling the people, when you go to talks like this, you kind of warm up by saying biographical stuff or more personal, trying to connect. And I was just ruminating on the salience of Central High to me personally, because I was born in 1947. Central High School was desegregated in 1957. I have direct memory as opposed to derived memories of the television coverage of the police, of the army or airborne forces in the city, and that whole episode. And I think it's probably my earliest crisp memories. It's always a little vague what things you remember and what things you think you remember, just because you know about them. But I do have, I think, direct memories of it. And when I said that to this audience, I completely choked up, which was completely surprising to me. It's not that I don't think of myself as an emotional person, but I normally, in a professional setting, when you're giving a talk, you don't get all choked up in a way that actually makes it hard to talk for a few seconds. So clearly it was tapping some very potent emotional well around race and civil rights and the struggles of that era. And that was just, incredibly, obviously moving, but also interesting for me to kind of reflect on that. The other thing I did in Little Rock is I went to the Occupy Little Rock site, about 40 people, so it's one of the smaller. but very robust. I mean, it's been there, you know, for now a couple of weeks. They were originally camped out in front of the Clinton Library, the presidential library, without permits or anything. And the city gave them a pretty nice spot in sight of the Clinton Library, but not right in front of the Clinton Library. And they told them that they can go to the Clinton Library every day with posters, you know, with banners and whatever, but that after 10 at night they have to go to their campsite, which is a couple of blocks away, although you can still see the library. And they decided that that was a reasonable accommodation, and the city gave them an indefinite permit for that spot. And the police, when they moved their camp from the Clinton Library to this other spot, actually helped them physically move their stuff. So it's quite a different scene from a lot of other cities. So they came, the last session of the Mid-South Sociological Association meetings that I was also speaking at, the last session was given by Joram Terborn, you know, the person who was here last week. And it was opened up to the community, and about 8 or 10 people from the Occupy Little Rock encampment came to Joram's talk, which was on inequality in the South and the rest of the world. It was sort of asking the question, what can we learn as sociologists about inequality in general from looking at inequality in the South? And they then invited us to come to the encampment and hold a forum on democracy, social movements, and the Occupy movement, and just to give our perspective on things, and then answer questions. And apparently, which was all fantastically interesting, also not something I've done. I mean, I've been in countless demonstrations, and you know, including the occupations here last spring, but I don't think I've ever led a seminar among people in the midst of a protest movement about the questions that they were interested in. And it was really, really interesting to do. They're very, extremely eager and responsive, completely unarrogant. I mean, no sense that we have all the answers. And you know, it was very much wanting to deepen the dialogue and explore various questions. I don't know how, if that's characteristic of the Occupy movements in every city. They were also unbelievably polite. I mean, Southern, you know, everybody, they all called me sir. I mean, these are scruffy, you know, 20-somethings, among others. The age range was from about 20 to 75. And there are plenty of middle-aged people. There was pretty even age distribution, actually. But everybody would call me sir. Just totally unnerving. There was one guy afterwards, he comes up to me, a little older than me, somewhat in his 70s, I suppose, with a kind of gray beard and a jacket with a Confederate flag on. And he said, you know, a lot of what you said made a lot of sense, but I want you to know I'm a real right winger. This sort of did not compute. Says, I think we need less government. That's the big problem. We got too much government. But I also, you know, I agree with you about the bankers, too, but we've got too much government. You know, it was this totally strange kind of...
But he was part of the Occupy movement?
Yeah, he had been camping there.
It's like Tea Party / Occupy.
Well, it's Ron, there were Ron Paul bumper stickers.
The libertarian
stuff. And so, you know, we talked for a while. Very congenial. I mean, the number of times I have extended conversations with people who announce I'm a real right winger, but I agreed with a lot of what you said. You know, so no, the thing was this: I was trying to really sort out what's the anchor to this configuration. You know, how are people making sense of their own ideas so that they can hold these views? And in a way, it's basically a view of the inevitability of government being beholden to bankers. Right? So if you think there's just absolutely no way in the world you're not going to get a government that's just going to be on the side of the rich and screw everybody else, then it's not so implausible to say, well, we'd be better off with less government. Right? So the idea that there's another alternative, you could have a democratically accountable government that is responsive to the will of the people who are engaged in politics in such a way to make that responsiveness sensible, you know, that's just seen as completely, utterly absurd. So one of the things that was discussed, we discussed in the encampment, and so the scene is, you know, there's tents all over the place in this it's basically an abandoned parking lot that we were in. So there are tents around, and they had a one of these nice fire pits that are elevated, portable fire pits that, you know, you see with, so a big blazing fire with lawn chairs around it. With Joran and I being a kind of a duet, because he would bring up European perspectives and I would talk about the American context. So it was as if we had rehearsed it. We hadn't. It was just really great. So one of the things they asked me is what I thought about the abolish the Fed idea. And I said, I think that's the wrong slogan. It should be democratize the Fed. Mm-hmm. That we need superordinate banking institutions to manage the money supply and to provide credit, because credit is an absolutely essential thing for both ordinary business activities, but also for all sorts of progressive activities. So you have some effort to create worker co-ops. They need to get credit, and you can't get credit without banks, and you can't have banks do this responsibly without some superordinate institution. The problem is, where's the accountability? So the simple slogan shouldn't be abolish the Fed, it should be democratize the Fed. And when people ask, well, what do you mean by that? You say, well, look, that's a real hard question, what the institutional design would be to actually make that work. But Bernie Sanders has created a committee with Joe Stiglitz and a few other people working on the question of how to create a democratically accountable Fed. So you can deal with the problem of the institutional design issues, which are hard, definitely a hard thing to do, by not imagining that the Occupy movement can come up with some fancy design for this, but they can then invoke. So people really like that. I found out later I was intervening in what was a bitter debate in that group, but they felt I did it in such a friendly way that it would actually push the discussion forward. So this guy, you know, he said, the Fed, it's an abomination. The last time the National Bank was, do you know the last time the National Bank was abolished? Andrew Jackson. And the United States did just fine without it. And I said, well, you know, the world's a little different now than the 1830s. And the United States didn't do all that fine in many ways after the abolition of the National Bank under Andrew Jackson. So it was all extremely interesting experience for me. Is the Occupy Madison thing an actual? I mean, it hasn't been getting any play. Is there one?
It got brief play because who is the athlete who showed up?
John Carlos.
Yeah, he showed up.
But is it actually still around?
I think so.
I heard that they got the city moved them. And gave them a place on East Washington.
Yep, I drove past it yesterday. Yeah. It's in like a parking lot, right? They have tents set up.
How far out on East Washington?
I'm pretty bad with distances. I guess it's a couple intersections away. Yeah.
Oh, but it's near the Capitol, a couple of intersections east.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I feel after my, I'll bring them greetings from Occupy Little Rock. And I'll wear my Occupy Little Rock button. All right. Let's see if there's any other business to take care of. I think not. I think we're chugging along. Does anybody need? I have a few.
I can pass right
there. Okay. There. So let's see where we were on our last lecture. We ended. I think we were at number four under Roman numeral 2, is that right? Nobody remembers? I think that's where we were. So just to recapitulate the general structure of where we're going. I raised the question about what does it mean to talk about the theoretical specificity of a category? So we have this category, racial domination, racial oppression, racial inequality. They're all nouns modified by the word racial. And so our tasks are to first understand what is the theoretical specificity of the category race in contrast to other kinds of social division, and then what does it mean for race to get organized in a manner which justifies the words oppression, domination, inequality. What is the abstract category within which race or racism would count as a specific type? So this is the problem of developing concepts. Race isn't a category, just a standalone category. It's part of a menu of categories. And the task then is to figure out what the conceptual lines of demarcation are between race and other categories, which nevertheless form part of a kind of family of categories. Then I offered in this respect the idea that the broader category, so the more abstract category within which we can then locate race, is this notion of communal identity, and then alienated forms of communal identity which constitute the basis for social division and oppression. But that the more abstract notion is communal identity, of which there are many types. There are ethnic identities, there are kinship identities sometimes, which are tribal identities which have communal characters, clan identities, nationalist identities, sometimes plausibly religious identities constitute communal identities. Communal identities are identities that are rooted in the forms of direct face-to-face interaction that constitute the sociability of everyday life in a social setting. Community, the concept of community can refer to any scale. You can have the community of a neighborhood. You can even think of yourself as part of the community of the world if you feel that kind of social connectedness and interaction with people everywhere. Mostly communal identities tend to be localized, but they may be modular so that an ethnic community can feel the same kind of kindred sociability with like ethnic communities that they've never interacted with. An alienated form of community, then, is a form of community in which a communal identity becomes the basis for oppression and exclusion and domination, where those identities get mobilized in antagonism to other identities. This, then, is kind of parallel. There's a sort of roughly parallel logic to class and gender. We can talk about class as an alienated form of the division of labor. The division of labor is an organic property of any complex production system of production. The division of labor can get organized then in an alienated form when it constitutes the basis for domination and exclusion and oppression and exploitation in the case of class. And class then could be one way of thinking about it is that it's an alienated division of labor. And similarly, we can think of patriarchy as an alienated structure of social relations rooted in sex. Well, in these terms then, ethnicity, religion, language, nationality, tribe, all of these can be communal identities. And in certain situations, they can be alienated in ways that create division, antagonism, and oppression. And race, then, is one of these. Okay, that's the first move on levels of on specificity. We've now located racial division as one instance of a whole family of possible divisions. Then the question is, what renders race a specific form of this? And the kind of exercise to think about is to think of all the things that occasionally get called racial division and to see, first of all, empirically, is there something that they all hold in common that would justify them seeing these all as the same sort of thing? or not. And sometimes the term, of course, can be used outside of its proper domain. A black and white in the U.S., Jew and Muslim, or Jew and Arab in Israel, Palestine. Anti-Semitism in Europe, the Nazis' view of Jews. A Catholic Protestant in Northern Ireland, Hutu and Tutsi in Rwanda. Untouchable castes in India. So these are all things which might be actually the same as racial division, not just kindred. They might actually be the same, or they might not. And the big historical recent example was this debate in the United Nations over whether Zionism is a form of racism. Now that was a very hot and contentious debate. It led to the walkout from the International Convention on Racism meetings by the United States and a bunch of other countries who were not prepared to even entertain the discussion of whether there were such fundamental similarities between Zionism and other forms of racism that it should be properly seen that way. So we've got a list of things, of possibilities, and the question is which of these actually legitimately from a sociological point of view. So we're not speaking now from a kind of polemical point of view where you might get some cachet by calling something racism, but from the actual structure of the mechanisms involved, which of these should be called racism. And for that we need to really develop a proper definition of racial oppression. And my approach to this is summarized in 4 points. So this is under the specificity of racial oppression. So first, racial division is a socially recognized distinction between people based on biological lineage. You are born into a racial category by virtue of the racial categories of your parents. To know what a person's race is, the first thing you ask is, what is the race of their parents? Race is something passed on through biological reproduction. Yeah?
I mean, that's not universal across. I mean, what about the case of Brazil, where children can be born where they're considered different, a different racial category than...
But it's still derived, you can still, the answer to the question, what is the race of the child, is derived from the race of the parents, even if it's different from the race of the parents. You know, you don't acquire it from something other than your genes. Mm-hmm. It may be that because of the mixed quality and the criteria that's used to classify people, that a lighter-skinned child of darker-skinned parents, which can happen because of genetic sorting, would end up being classified differently. But it's still, everybody would say, yes, they still got it from their parents. Right? So it's still a biological lineage. It would just be that it would be the grandparents or the great-grandparents whose particular genes are being transmitted to those particular kids to give them lighter skins than their parents. The lighter skin would be evidence, would be clearer evidence that in that biological lineage there's mixture of white and black. And therefore, in the Brazilian case, that leads to a different classification. But still, I think it's the case that it's a socially recognized distinction based on biological lineage. It's the biological lineage that's in play. You are born into a racial category by virtue of this biological lineage. Sociologists call this an ascriptive category. That is, it's something that's ascribed to you. It's not something you choose. There are special cases in which there are, however, socially validated ways of escaping a racial classification. Sometimes this has the character of passing. That is, you can just disguise your race because of the ambiguities of the identifiers. But then there are cases where it's actually, there are official ways you can change your race. That's typically the case where lineages are very complicated and you can decide that the lineage that matters is not the one that you initially thought you had. You know, you have multiple lineages and you can then choose which is the one that's most salient. The more that's the case, the more it begins to look like ethnicity rather than race. That is, when you can choose your lineage if you have multiple lineages. Nevertheless, I think the key, this is getting into more initial complexity than we need to. The key idea is that to be a racial classification system. It has to be rooted in biological lineage. The actual classification systems that come from this biological lineage, however, are not themselves biological. They are entirely socially constructed. There's nothing whatsoever natural and given about the classification systems, even though to count as a racial classification system, they have to be a classification of biological lineages. The clearest example is the following. In the U.S., a person is black if they have any black ancestors. It's what in the segregation era was called the one-drop rule. Now, imagine the following alternative racial classification system. It's still a one-drop rule, but one drop of white ancestry makes you white. So you could imagine the following racist ideology. White blood purifies black, the contamination of a black ancestor. So it's still racist. It's still anti-black. But it says whites are so angelic and saintly or whatever that white blood purifies the contamination. So all you need is any white ancestor and you're white. Well, then we would have virtually no African Americans in the United States. Would be entirely a white population because virtually no black person by our historical classifications who has been in the United States for generations, this is different if you're a new immigrant, but who's part of the African American history, would not have some white ancestor. Many of them being Thomas Jefferson, as it were. Well, not because he was so prolific, profligate, but because it's enough generations ago that there's plenty of dissemination of the gene pool. So the one-drop rule would be a whiteness-making rule in that world. The one-drop rule is a blackness-making rule in our system of classification. And they're exactly symmetrical. And it shows the complete arbitrariness of a classification system. Nevertheless, what is being classified is biological heritage. So that's my first point would be that something is not properly described as a racial category, some other kind of social division, but it's not a racial division if it's not linked to biological lineage. Now that's one of the reasons why the Zionism as racism thing had some plausibility, because after all, passing of Jewish identity through the female line is one of the, particularly for more Orthodox Jews, it's one of the central features of being Jewish. It's not, and you know, the most Orthodox Jews are very squeamish about converts and really don't think converts are real Jews. You know, and there's this whole problem with the right of return in Israel because of the way the religious laws are controlled by the most conservative Orthodox rabbinate, that unless the conversion was done by an Orthodox rabbi, it's not considered a real conversion, and therefore those Jews who want to immigrate are not considered real Jews. And there's this famous case of a young woman raised Jewish completely from childhood. Her father was Jewish, the mother was not, and the mother hadn't converted, but raised the child in a completely Jewish kosher home. And the religious authorities in Israel wouldn't give her citizenship. Now, to me, that's the kind of thing that would indicate that it's not so far-fetched to say that it's racial. You know, because biological lineage is the touchstone criterion for deciding are you in or are you out. Not belief, not identity, not cultural capital, not all the other things that could be the basis for deciding who are you, what's your identity. But the test is, what's your biological lineage? Yeah.
Could that be exactly because it is descriptive? I mean, theoretically, if somebody wanted to move to Israel, they'd have to say, oh, I'm Jewish now.
They still would have to prove conversion.
Well, right, but what I'm saying, it would still be a choice. Like, you still choose to be Jewish, whereas because this is a scripted.
Oh yeah, so the
it kind of like weeds out the.
Right. So the but even so, the most conservative rabbis still allow for conversion. They just make it very tough. But the key thing was when you had a child who was raised Jewish from the start, but lacked the biological heritage, that child had never converted. Right. So this girl, you know, she had been bat mitzvahed. She was a very observant Jew. She was kosher. She never converted to Judaism. And the Orthodox rabbis insisted she had to convert in order to be a Jew. And she thought that was a complete affront. Understandably, she's right, it is. It's an affront to an identity that's ethno-religious, but it's not an affront to an identity that's meant to be biological, and therefore, in order to be an honorary member, so to speak, you have to go through this particular ritual, which since her mother hadn't done, she would have to do. Right, that was the story in this famous case. Okay, that's the first point, though. Second point, typically the biological lineage is linked to some socially recognizable and symbolically salient visible physical attribute, what are called phenotypes, phenotypic differences. But this need not always be the case. That is the typical way, and it's one of the reasons why we think in the United States of race, the marker of race being skin color, skin being just the iconic way of identifying, you know, a cluster of physical attributes. It's obviously not just skin color, it's the it's hair and eyes and other physical properties. But clearly, racism and racial division does not require clear phenotypic differences. The Nazi anti-Semitism case is the clearest. And it's certainly the Nazi anti-Semitism is racial. It's not a religious oppression, because Jewish converts to Catholicism were still classified as Jews by the Nazis. You couldn't convert yourself out of it. And that's different, by the way, from you know, in the Spanish conquest of Islamic Spain and the forced conversion of Muslims and Jews to Christianity. Once they were converted, that was fine. They weren't hassled anymore. There was the problem of false conversion. You know, there was this, during the Spanish Inquisition, there was the issue of whether or not the Morenos, or I think is, Morenos were Muslim converts or Jewish converts?
Muslim
converts. You know, there was suspicion that this wasn't for real. They were just doing it for convenience. But that's a separate issue. That I think that was not a racial classification problem. It was strictly religious. But the Nazis wasn't religious, yeah.
With the Nazis, though, didn't they maintain that there were phenotypic differences? Granted, it was pseudoscience and that, but there was this underlying...
Right, but you know, they still rounded up blonde, blue-eyed Jews who were indistinguishable from Germans. But it is typically the case because, and this also reflects the biological lineage aspect of racism, that there is an attempt at caricaturing and characterizing difference as phenotypic, even if it's not true. The first two of these do not inherently imply any form of oppression or domination. Right, just recognition of a difference. So in principle, you could have the first two of these criteria met, that is, there's a phenotypic attribute, and the classification is based on biological lineage. You could have both of these present without there being any antagonism, domination, or oppression defined by these categories. When racial division becomes racial oppression, when it corresponds to some socially significant exclusion. Typically, this has an economic dimension, but also political and cultural dimensions. Right, so racial division could, in principle, be benign. It certainly, in practice, ceases to be when that classification principle corresponds to some other socially salient kind of exclusion. Access to economic resources, political rights, and cultural stigma. Yeah.
So are there any examples where that's actually happened, though, where there's been a racial division that wasn't based on some kind of oppressive...
Well, in the United States today, it's a socially recognized racial distinction between East Asians and Caucasians. That's a classification system. It's broadly called racial, not just ethnic. It's racial because it applies to Chinese third generation Chinese Americans. They're called Chinese Americans. A third generation Polish American who doesn't have any particular Polish cultural identity isn't called a Polish American anymore, right? To be called a Polish American means you've chosen to assign to yourself that part of your ancestry as a salient part of your identity. But a third generation Polish American or Irish American who has no connection and no feelings about that would just be called American. But if you're East Asian, if you're Chinese or of Japanese descent, you'll still be called Japanese American. And the reason is because there are phenotypic markers of such, of that ethnic heritage, and it still has some salience. But it really doesn't correspond to any significant, there'd be little side cases, but it's really not a basis for any kind of exclusionary practices, I think. It was historically, but I don't, yeah.
So isn't it also, can't racial divisions also become exploitive related? In the case of colonial powers that come and impose racial categories on groups that might otherwise not, for the sake of their own.
Sure.
So there could be racial exploitation in the sense even the identity of being white, that sort of communal identity benefits. It benefits the groups who then become white, but
right, so the issue of the connection of race to exploitation is whether we want to say that it's racial exploitation or that race is being used to create a form of class exploitation. It's not exactly clear what racial exploitation means per se. It's clear what racial oppression would mean, but racial exploitation seems like a shorthand. So American slavery was class exploitation based on racial classification. But it wasn't exactly racial exploitation per se. Race was the basis of cementing and reproducing and allocating people to a particular form of class relations within which exploitation took place. And it's absolutely the case that, for example, the Hutu-Tutsi distinction, which in the context of Rwanda is viewed as a racial division, not an ethnic division. And racial, the language of disgust that's associated with race is used in the genocide in the conflict in Rwanda, where Tutsis were referred to as a subspecies, an inferior species. It was a biological language that was used, not just as a despised group, but as a clearly a biologized. And therefore, and since the status was passed on through lineage, I think it is perfectly reasonable, even though we wouldn't recognize that classification system as having any salience, it doesn't seem to me inappropriate to say, yes, that was a form of racial division. And the fourth point is when racial division takes the form of racial oppression, the oppressed group is also invariably stigmatized, given an inferior social status, and in the extreme case regarded as an inferior type of human being in the biological and not just the social sense. And in the most extreme cases, even seen as subhuman. The most stigmatizing and denigrating forms of racism regard it not just as an inferior type, like a breed. Some dogs are superior to other dogs with respect to the things you care about in some dogs, their trainability, let's say. Not just a superior breed, but actually a different species. It's possible that the stigmatization and status denigration can continue even if the exclusions have largely disappeared. In Germany, prior to the Nazis, the exclusions of Jews, that is their prohibitions from entering various occupations, from getting an education, from being engaged in just the ordinary interactions of German life, those exclusions had virtually disappeared. It was not the Nazi anti-Semitism took hold not in a context of legalized discrimination against Jews or practical exclusions. Now, to be sure, there would be exclusive clubs, there'd be all sorts of, just as there still is vestiges of that in the United States where Jews would be excluded. But really, secularized German Jews were fully integrated into the economic, political, cultural life of Germany in the 1920s. But the stigmatization and the cultural correlates of racial exclusion still existed sufficiently strongly that it became a mobilizing basis for the Nazis. Now, this provisional definition of the racialized form of oppression, the way I've defined it with these four criteria, doesn't directly make any reference to class. It does indirectly in criterion three. That is, criterion three about exclusion does say that racial divisions become oppressions when they get connected to some kind of exclusion, and one possibility is an exclusion that's anchored in class. Right, so racial oppression isn't oppressive if it doesn't connect it to exclusions of one sort or another. Racial division is just a difference, a division, unless there's an exclusionary practice. But those could be just cultural, that's one possibility. It can be political around citizens' rights, or it can be economic, where then it becomes invested with a class content. That third criterion, then, is the site for the discussion of the interaction of race and class. Okay, now let's turn to Roman numeral three, a class analysis of racial oppression. In thinking about racial oppressions and their link to class structures, one kind of question that's often asked is, what are the origins of racial inequality? Now, I think that's what are the origins, looking for sources. I think that's actually a less important question than the question, what explains the durability of racial divisions and the difficulty of eliminating racial inequality? The second question, I think, is the more important one. What are the origins of racial discrimination, racial oppression? In and of itself is not, to me, particularly important, unless it's necessary for answering the second question, why is it so durable? Because fundamentally, from a normative point of view, what I'm concerned with are the conditions for the elimination of racial domination and inequality. And those may have relatively little to do with what the origins were. Just as with gender. I don't think the question of what are the historical origins of gender inequality and patriarchy is all that important to the question, what new institutions do we need to hasten the demise of forms of gender oppression and inequality. I'm not saying that as a necessary truth. It could be that there are aspects of the solution which require really understanding the origins. Sometimes the evidence for what is the generative process that's enduring, the evidence comes from origins. So origins can be a privileged site for gathering evidence about how a particular structure works. But that's a pretty special context. And I think it's a mistake to be preoccupied with origins. We want to be preoccupied with what explains the durability of a relation of oppression. And then we might come with the view, yes, to really solve that problem, we have to look at origins. I'm not, in any case, going to mainly focus on origins. The question of durability then really involves two complementary questions, and these are not the same, and they often get collapsed. What processes actively reproduce racial cleavage? And what processes block challenges to eliminating racial cleavages? Now, those could be completely different problems. They don't have to be the same. They could be the same. It could be the main thing that actively reproduces it is precisely what blocks challenges. But these could be different. There could be, it could be entirely that to really challenge racial cleavage would require challenging capitalism, because it would be expensive to get rid of racial division because of the extreme costs of eliminating marginalization in the current American economy, and that would be a heavy drain on capital accumulation. So it's the class problem that blocks challenges, but that doesn't actively reproduce. It's not the same as what's actively reproducing racism. Racism may be serving only minimal functions. It may not be necessary for capitalism any longer. The kind of capitalism we have now may not depend very much on racism, whereas the kind of capitalism in the South in the 19th century completely depended upon racism. You couldn't have a slave-based exploitation system embedded in capitalism without it being racialized. It wouldn't be stable. So racism was organic to the system of class relations in the 19th century. Arguably, it's of relatively thin importance for the reproduction of class relations today. But nevertheless, to fully challenge racism would be extremely expensive, and that would be the problem of what blocks racism, the challenges to racial cleavage. A second theme around the class analysis of racism concerns the problem of who benefits from racism. Now, I want to more focus on the on this discussion on the next page. That is to really try to figure out why is racial inequality so robust? What is the deeper mechanism that explains this robustness? That's what I want to focus on. But let's, before we take the break, let's just very briefly just run through these alternatives of who benefits from racism. And let me explain what's in play here. But this isn't what I want to focus on. I think this problem is more straightforward and the readings cover it, whereas the question of this, of the robust mechanisms that make racial division as hard to dislodge, I think that's a less clear-cut matter. Okay, here are four views about who benefits from racism. The first view is that white workers exploit black workers, that there's a transfer of surplus from black workers to white workers. And thus, white and black workers, if this were true, really would constitute two different classes. If it is the case that white workers, through some set of mechanisms, actually are the exploiters of black workers, then one would have to say that white and black workers constitute two different classes. This is a strong version of the internal colonialism argument, or theories of super exploitation. White workers and white capitalists form a racial alliance because they share common interests in the exploitation of black workers. White workers would be worse off if black workers simply disappeared. Right, so the claim that white workers exploit black workers are, a test of it is, if black workers simply disappeared, would white workers be worse off? If they're better off by virtue of their being black workers, what it means is part of their standard of living comes from the labor expended by black workers. Now, if you really think about this more carefully, there's some ambiguity as to whether this means simply that white workers are less exploited because black workers are more exploited. That's one version. And you might not want to describe that as a transfer from black to white, but simply as a privilege given whites by virtue of the super exploitation of blacks. But I think in practical terms, there's not that big a distance between the idea that white workers are able to be less exploited because they collaborate with capitalists in having black workers super exploited. In South Africa, in the heyday of apartheid, a pretty good case could be made that white workers were net beneficiaries of the super exploitation of black workers, to the point where they weren't exploited at all. Okay, that's the first position. The second position is that white workers oppress black workers but don't exploit them. They benefit from exclusionary practices but don't receive any direct transfers. This is the split labor market thesis. White workers would not be worse off if black workers disappeared. They're better off just because they have less competition by virtue of being able to exclude black workers. But if black workers disappeared, they would still have less competition. It's not the presence of black labor being transferred to them that makes them better off. It's just their ability to close part of the labor market to black workers. That's the white workers oppress black workers thesis. The third one is that white workers neither oppress nor exploit black workers. Capitalists differentially exploit different categories of workers, but all workers suffer from this differential exploitation. This is the traditional Marxist class analysis. Capitalists alone benefit from racism. If the expression black and white unite and fight suggests that if the racial division could be overcome, then both black and white workers would be better off because they could reduce the overall rate of exploitation. It might be the case that that the unity between black and white workers would benefit black workers more than it would benefit white workers because they are more exploited under capitalism. But it is not the case that a unity of black and white workers would lead to wages that were halfway between. That is, it's not the case that white wages would go down and black wages would go up. The solidarity effects would raise the wages of both, albeit the wages of black workers more than white workers. That's the view that capitalists exploit both of them, but at differential rates because of racial division. And then finally, there's the view associated with William Julius Wilson, that whatever is the case, the differential exploitation of black and white workers is of decreasing relevance. What's increasingly the case is that segments of the black population are entirely marginalized from the system of exploitation altogether. That's the theory of the underclass. That the current form of racial class division is that we have an underclass of black people who are oppressed but not exploited, welfare mothers permanently underemployed, the criminal underclass, etc. But those parts of the black population which are fully integrated into the working class are no longer very different from white workers who are fully integrated into the working class. The differential exploitation has declined a lot, so that the racial division within the working class is much weaker than it used to be. The big division is between people who are marginalized from the class structure altogether and the class and class relations. When William Julius Wilson talks about the declining significance of race, that's basically what he's meaning, that race is no longer the primary divider. What's really the divider is this underclass division, which is a racialized division, but it's really people being pushed out of the class structure rather than a division within the class structure. Now, we could, of course, spend the whole rest of the time talking about that. These are big and difficult issues. What I'd like to do is stop for our break and then turn to this question of why racialized inequality is especially robust. And here I'm going to be presenting an argument that is not in any of the readings. It's a specific perspective on why it should be that a biologically anchored form of oppression, that is racism, again, being based on this biological lineage, what is it that that then kicks in that makes it particularly robust? And that's what we'll discuss after the break. So let's reconvene at a quarter after.
It's not relevant to anything that we've talked about yet, and if we're going to get to it, we can address it later. But the reading from Albert and Hanel, Marxism and Socialist Theories, the first couple of pages we were talking about how the VNF received the base superstructure framework for understanding culture and all, and that kind of stuff. And I think this was written after Cohen's theory of history, and I was just wondering...
Well, they wouldn't have paid any attention to Cohen anyway.
Okay, so, well, they were basically saying that historical materialism and Marxist analysis is, like, too focused on the economy, and then I was thinking of restrictive historical materialism, and I was wondering if you thought that Cohen's argument was a proper response to this.
Well, no, because they would object to the idea that racism is to be explained by its functions for capitalism at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they would say it has some intersection with capitalism, capitalists may take advantage of it, but they want to see racism as having its own foundations within this kind of alienated community identity. And the same for sexism with respect to the family. And not see it as functionalized by anything else. So they don't want to create any explanatory hierarchy between the economy, the state, and community and kinship. They have these four domains: economy, state, community, and kinship. They don't want any functional hierarchy among them. These are just four domains of social life within which oppressions get built up around some core social practice. So they all have core social practices that are essential for social life, which then get transformed into a form of domination. Racial domination is this transformation of community in their view. But they don't want to say, and that occurs because of its functions for the economic forms of domination. So the base superstructure argument is used for two purposes. One is to explain why class structures are stable. Aha, they're stable because there are all these other institutions which support them. But it's also used to then provide explanations for other forms of oppression. Why do we have persistent racism? Because it's good for capitalism. And that's what they want to reject. They want to reject the explanation of racial inequality by virtue of the functions it fulfills. They may acknowledge that it does fulfill those functions. It is good for capitalism sometimes, maybe not always. They want to reject the notion that that has anything to do with how you explain racism. And that's to the extent that they're being careful as opposed to just rhetorical or polemical. I think that's what they mean by the rejection of the base superstructure.
So do they at least accept that race came about originally in the beginning because of class division?
It's hard for me to imagine how they, in the U.S., certainly in the American context, how they could not accept that race was deployed as a way of consolidating slavery as a form of class relations. You know, it just seems absurd to say that just as a happy coincidence. So I assume that they would agree with that, but that wouldn't have anything to do with the enduring explanations of it. Okay, what I want to do is to explore the possibility that the key process that's working, in a sense, in the silent background of race is the way this particular way of creating social division becomes divisions between families. And that families and kinship are this crucial way in which solidarities proliferate within classes to create class-wide solidarity in the working class. So kinship structures are one of the ways of smoothing out social divisions within classes that otherwise would prevent solidarity. And that what race does is create a real fracture in that process. And it's why miscegenation is such a salient issue in racial domination. Because miscegenation, the prohibition against cross-racial marriage, is a prohibition against cross-racial kinship structures, is really what's in play there. And let me just so that's where we want to go. This has to do with the question of how to think about the interests that are involved in racial division as it connects to class division. Let me go through the steps of this argument. I've given a little simple table here where we have two kinds of workers, high-paid skilled workers and low-paid unskilled workers. Let's call those good jobs and bad jobs within the working class, two strata of the working class. And we have two kinds of races, two kinds of workers on a racial classification, white and black. Okay? Now, if there was no race, if we just had white workers, there would be a problem of class solidarity between skilled and unskilled workers. One way that capitalism can reproduce itself is by creating divisions along skill lines between skilled and unskilled workers. That reduces class-wide solidarity. So class-wide solidarity across the skilled-unskilled line is something that creates a stronger working class, with greater capacity to challenge capital, right? Skilled workers and unskilled workers may often have quite different interests. It's not the case that the interests of skilled workers and unskilled workers are identical. Skilled workers, for example, may have real interest in preventing unskilled workers from getting skills, because if they got the skills, there'd be more competition for the skilled job. So a classic thing that skilled workers do is create various forms of exclusion to restrict entry of unskilled workers to the skill acquisition process. Unions in the skilled trades have often done that, so that the only people who can get access to those trades are have to have personal connections. Right? So there is an issue of interests between skilled and unskilled labor. Even when they're racially homogeneous, right? So even in a racially homogeneous context, there's an issue. Now let's see what happens when we add race as a complexity to the texture of this problem. And let's distinguish two kinds of situations. In the first situation, there is a significant economic gap between high-paid and low-paid workers, and this corresponds to a racial division between white and black workers. So racial stratification is closely linked to stratification within the working class. White workers are mostly concentrated in the high-skilled jobs, the more privileged part of the working class in terms of skills. Black workers are mostly concentrated in the unskilled part. So that's the first situation, where there's a racial correspondence. The second situation is there is a significant economic gap between high-paid and low-paid workers, but there's only one race. So we're comparing the same economic distance between skilled and unskilled, but in one case, this corresponds to a racial division, and in another case, there's no racial correspondence. The simplest way is to think of there being only one race. It could be that there's more than one race, but there's no racial correspondence to the economic division. Now, let's look at this first case. Here's the problem. So long as there is significant inequality between skilled and unskilled workers, if the racial division between blacks and whites is overcome, so this is in the first situation where there is the association, right, between race and economic division. If the racial division between blacks and whites is overcome, some white workers will be worse off than they would otherwise have been, even if the average white worker improves his or her position. So if you have a big gap between skilled workers and unskilled workers, and let's be really clear about it, that all whites are skilled workers and all blacks are unskilled workers. Let's suppose you get class-wide solidarity that overcomes racial division. And this improves the wages of both skilled and unskilled workers. So we're adopting the framework that the lack of solidarity hurts everybody. So both skilled and unskilled workers' wages go up because of solidarity. But because of solidarity, some white workers now become unskilled. That is, if you've overcome the racial division, it means that some blacks will become skilled workers and some whites will become unskilled workers. So even though the wages of both skilled and unskilled workers have gone up, the wages of some white workers will go down. If you've overcome the racial divisions and created class-wide solidarity. Solidarity among privileged workers then faces a trade-off between gains for the average person in the skilled group, if they were solidaristic with black workers, and potentially significant losses to some members of the privileged groups as they lose good jobs to black workers. And that becomes a really complex calculus. That is, some white workers are going to end up with worse jobs, even if all skilled workers and all unskilled workers have their wages increased. Solidarity among privileged workers, among the skilled workers in this story, therefore they face this dilemma. Are we going to only ask the question, does the average person improve, or are we going to worry about the fact that some people in the privileged group are going to be worse off? Here's a simple kind of numerical example. Suppose 80%, and I should have written this out, but it'll be in the note. You can get it online afterwards. But here's the example. This is a concocted example. Suppose 80% of the working class is white and 20% black. Suppose at the beginning of this process, all white workers are in higher paying jobs and all blacks in lower paying jobs. This is extreme racial polarization. Suppose that the good paying jobs pay $20 an hour and the bad jobs pay $10 an hour. So this is really simple. So all whites are earning $20 an hour and all blacks are earning $10 an hour because blacks are in the unskilled jobs and whites are in the skilled jobs. Now suppose we magically got rid of racism so that blacks and whites are evenly distributed in the two jobs, and suppose that because of this increased solidarity, the average earnings of both strata of workers improves, so that the well-paid skilled workers now make $22 an hour and the poorly paid workers make $15 an hour. So both categories of workers, as categories, have had their wages go up, right? But we no longer have the racial polarization associated with this. This would mean that 20% of the white workers would have to have their wages decline from $20 to $15 an hour. That is, 20% of the white workers would end up in the unskilled jobs if now there's no racial division at all, if race has disappeared as a basis for allocating people to positions. The unskilled job is earning a lot more, 50% more than it used to. The skilled job is earning more, 10% more than it used to. But still, 20% of the whites are worse off than they were before. Right? And that's true even though the average white skilled worker would have had their wages go up. Now, the conclusion is simple, I think. Where there is a deep racial stratification, then interracial solidarity will hurt some advantaged white workers. If there's going to be deep racial solidarity, cross-race solidarity, to get rid of any racial differentials, some white workers are going to end up being worse off. And that therefore creates in the collective of privileged workers a problem of complexity, of trade-offs. That's the first situation. So, now the second situation, suppose that the sharply divided categories of privileged and disadvantaged workers did not correspond to a racial divide. So we're in the same story, $20 for skilled workers, $10 for unskilled workers. Suppose that the working class is racially and ethnically homogeneous across strata. So that It's the same kind of people who are skilled workers as unskilled workers. This is Sweden before recent immigration, right? Everybody's a Swede. How would this change the problem from the point of view of this trade-off that I just talked about? Here's, I think, the key thing. Without the racial division, over time, there's likely to develop a relatively thick pattern of social ties across the boundary between skilled and unskilled workers. There'll be many skilled workers who will have a brother who's an unskilled worker. There's many fathers who will have daughters and sons who are unskilled. There'll be many of unskilled fathers who will have skilled. They'll be scrambling. People get sorted across this barrier, and their kinship ties will span the barrier. It'll be relatively common for people's deep communal ties, whether it's to neighbors or immediate family or more distant kin, to cross the divide between skilled and unskilled. People would have children, siblings, cousins, parents, blah, 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 and certainly friends across this divide. Now, I think even more crucially, people without such direct hard social ties across the boundary, so even people who don't have a family member across the boundary, would exist in a socioeconomic space in which they would have a reasonable probability of having such ties in the future. So if you're a young worker in the privileged strata and you are just forming a family, you know there's a reasonable chance that you'll have a kid who might eventually be in the less privileged segment. Not all kids do well in school. Some of them screw up in high school, whatever. So you know there's a reasonable chance of somebody that you'll have a close tie to crossing that boundary. Now the question then is, what does this have to do with the problem at hand? I think what happens then is that one's answer to the question, what's in your interests, change. And the thing that changes is the definition of the self in self-interest.
It seems to take sort of a Rawlsian approach to it, you know, sort of like behind the veil of ignorance. Like if you don't know the outcome of your offspring or the outcome of your connections in the future, you're more likely to.
But this isn't for moral reasons. The Rawlsian thing has to do with, I mean, it has a certain Rawlsian flavor, but I think it's more here. It's more the following. People, when we talk about the self-interest of people, the word self, we always assume means more than just the individual biological person. It at least encompasses their immediate family. People care about what's going to be in the interests of their children. And the trade-offs then, would you rather have a, if you ask somebody, which world would you prefer? A world where privileged people get $20 an hour and unskilled workers get 10, or a world in which skilled get 22 and unskilled get 15, which of those two worlds would you want, when you have a high probability of having deep social connections across that boundary, then it becomes much simpler. Of course I'd want the world where both categories are earning more.
But couldn't that also be because in the second category, skilled workers are earning more, even if
No, well, remember the racial case. In the racial case, they are torn between these two worlds because they know that 20% of their fellow skilled workers are going to actually earn less. In this case, since they have identity connections across the boundary because of social ties, and some of these are not just probabilistic. For most people, there are real ties across this boundary. Their sense of what's in their selfish material interest, the self part of that, becomes stretched when you have this, you know, this broader array of possibilities. Is the self the individual, one's family, one's extended family, one's friends? When you worry about, is this in my interest or not? In my self-interests. What's the circle of people? Market relations continually push for an atomization of the definition of relevant units of self-interest. Kinship and community push for stretching this unit. So we have contending forces in capitalism. Markets tend to narrow the sense of self. My self-interests are my own job. kinship ties and community relations, the kind of communal identities that we have, tend to stretch our sense of self. I'm interested in what's good for my community, not just what's good for me personally, individually, in terms of my job. And since interests have a temporal dimension, one has material interests in one's children's future, not just instantaneously for the present. If this is right, then the probability of such ties across the privileged, underprivileged strata matter for the definition of interests. So in Sweden, for 50 years, skilled workers strongly supported a labor movement which worked to flatten wage differentials between highly skilled and unskilled workers. This was called the solidarity wage. The central ethos of the labor movement was to reduce wage differentials, not to increase them. And I think the racial homogeneity of the Swedish working class contributed to that, because it meant not just merely that you saw people like you, but they were people you had connections to.
Do you think it made it harder to sort people into class categories that way, because there was less to distinguish yourself from, like, the other?
Well, it meant it wasn't necessarily harder to sort people into classes. It just meant the criteria for sorting were not extraneous. That is, the criteria for becoming a skilled or unskilled worker, for getting more or less education, had much more to do with individual temperament, with individual desires and ambitions. Much weaker class inheritance in Sweden than the United States. But also it didn't matter as much. I mean, I have Swedish academic friends whose kids are factory workers, and they don't think it's such a big deal. They don't feel like their kids are downwardly mobile, because it doesn't matter that much. They live perfectly comfortable lives anyway, because the wage differentials are just not that big. So here's then the kind of point of this, which is in 3.2 here. The key issue here is the way race, especially, and ethnicity, usually to a somewhat lesser extent, defines the communities of deep interpersonal relations, especially kinship. Racialized social division is a powerful obstacle to intermarriage. Intermarriage is one of the key features of racism, blocking the formation of families. And this blocks the proliferation of the kinds of ties that stretch interests across that division. The problem, then, of intermarriage across racial division has always been one of the most salient, biting features of racism, and it's fundamental, I think, to cementing the social mechanisms of racial oppression and of creating its effects on the fracturing of solidarity. What a racially homogeneous world does is renders the stretching of solidarities and identifications across the social locations that are proximate to oneself. So the class divisions that are close to one's own class, they become spanned through these social ties within community more readily than when you can concoct a system in which there's an association between race and class and no ties between races, no interpersonal ties between races. So here's then, I think, the kicker. So here's what's in play here. When a cleavage between privileged and underprivileged categories within a class structure corresponds to a racial division, this means that cross-strata solidarities will be weakened. Cross-strata solidarities will be weakened when it corresponds to a racial division, because the intergenerational and kinship structure of solidarities will reinforce rather than undermine the strata division between privileged and underprivileged. And this means that the collective basis for solidaristic struggle against the exclusions that generate the division are also likely to be weaker. It also means that the issue in situation number one that I laid out before are likely to become much stronger. The fate of one's friends, children, kin within the privileged category would matter more than the fate of the average person in the category. So if all your friends and family are in the privileged category, and you know in my hypothetical example that 20% of the people in that category are going to be worse off if we get rid of racism in that first situation, then you'll be more concerned about sacrificing the well-being of 20% of the people in the privileged category, even if it means that you'd be a little bit better off. And I think that that's really at the core of what goes on with the distinctively racial aspect of social division, is the way it structures divisions between families by creating much more isolated kinship networks and friendship networks. So I'm using family a bit as the kind of metaphor for the core of this problem. Family is the clearest case where there's very strong ties where your interests depend upon the well-being of others, not just yourself. But it also applies to friends. It's why residential segregation is also crucial here, and because residential segregation undermines this somewhat weaker but still real sense of neighborliness and social ties to other people who you have ordinary interactions with. In the American context, one of the sharpest forms of racial oppression in the South were precisely around miscegenation rules, and they were among the last dismantled. The the court case which got rid of miscegenation rules was very late in this process, way after desegregation of education, for example. This then leads to two hypotheses. So hypothesis one is the greater the correspondence between strata within the working class and racial division, the weaker will be the potential for class solidarity across the strata. The weakened class solidarity will in turn reinforce the distinctively racial form of inequality. So that's why this is a system, right? Why it works together. The sharper the correspondence between strata, privileged and underprivileged economic strata within the working class, the sharper the correspondence between those strata and racial division, the weaker will be the potential for class solidarity across strata. So I'm not talking there about the weaker the probability of racial interracial solidarity. I'm just saying the class solidarity between skilled and unskilled will be undermined if it corresponds to a racial division. And the reason is this mechanism that of the narrowing or stretching of interests across that boundary due to family, kinship, friendship, neighborhood, these communal identities. And this weakened class solidarity will in turn reinforce the distinctively racial form of inequality. So what this means is that even if it is the case that capitalists exploit both privileged white workers and underprivileged black workers, even if they exploit them both, if that's the right way of understanding it, under conditions of a strong correspondence between race and class-based privileges, cross-race solidarity will be difficult to sustain, and thus collective challenges to racial oppression will be weakened. So that's the first hypothesis. But this also suggests another hypothesis. As the correspondence between class and or strata and race declines or is eroded, the basis for collective challenges to racial inequality increases. So that's the sort of flip side of the first hypothesis. As that correspondence, as the tightness of the correspondence between race and class declines, or strata and class, if we're thinking about divisions within the working class, as that correspondence gets weaker, what it means is that there will be more and more social ties that span those boundaries, and thus the possibility of solidarities across those boundaries will increase. And then this also will increase the capacities and interests in challenging the distinctively racial forms of inequality as well. This then, I think, can lead to a kind of specific formulation of the specificity of racial oppression within class analysis, as opposed to just the specificity of race as such. This is the specificity of how to think about racial oppression within class analysis. Forms of, is this what I put in here? Let's see, yes. So forms of social, that racial division can be seen as a particularly strong form of a more general theoretical category. That is, forms of social division that block the creation of communal ties through kinship. And in particular, that blocks the creation of communal ties across strata within the working class through kinship. And that's when you then look at how race intersects class in a class analysis, what you'd be asking is, why is it that class-wide solidarity is weakened when there is a racial division? And the answer that I'm proposing is that it because it undercuts a distinctive type of communal solidarity that otherwise is an important foundation for class solidarity, namely the way in which kinship ties crisscross the different economic divisions within the working class. The specific biological lineage mechanism in racialized social interaction is particularly salient because of the connection between its connection to family formation and kinship formation, and the role that such social relations play as building blocks for class solidarities. Let me very briefly turn to this last topic, the transformation of the Southern racial state, because I want us to start the class formation section on Wednesday. This is a research done by a PhD in the Wisconsin Sociology Department, David James. It was, in my judgment, just a totally brilliant piece of work. He was an interesting guy. He was a naval officer. He was a naval engineer on nuclear subs and taught ROTC at UW and resigned his commission in protest to the Vietnam War and entered graduate school here. So he was a Navy instructor in naval ROTC in Madison before he in protest, abandoned his commission. He was thus older than most graduate students when he entered graduate school in the early 70s. And he did this fantastically interesting dissertation. It was never published as a book. Did I tell you this story? He wrote this dissertation. I ended up being on his committee because I arrived, he was older than I was, but I arrived and his advisor and one other member of his committee had just left Madison and he was kind of stranded. So I became the stand-in for his advisor. It's an overstatement to say that I became his advisor. I did give him feedback and suggestions, but he wrote this extraordinarily good dissertation that combined historical archival data with quantitative data. But he became an assistant professor at the University of Indiana, which at the time didn't know what a book was. Tenure at the University of Indiana depended entirely on articles that you published in peer-reviewed journals. So some departments are like that. They had a formula for what a book was, which was one book is the equivalent of four articles. Right. And it's ridiculous. A book is more than... No, I think it was one book is the equivalent of three articles. And you needed six articles in peer-reviewed journals as the minimum to get tenure. So he had to face the choice. Was he going to just produce an article version of this, which is what he did? He got a very good ASR article. And then if he spent another two or three years turning this into a book, he would have been jeopardizing his tenure. So he decided to put it off until after he got tenure. By the time he had gotten tenure, it was then 7 years since he had written his dissertation and he was on to other things, and so it never got turned into a book. The basic idea of this fantastically good dissertation is the following. The racial state in the South gets constructed after the Civil War as a solution to a very serious problem of labor supply. That is, how, given the end of slavery, how can the black agricultural labor supply be subordinated to white agribusiness interests, given that slavery is no longer an option? The Southern racial state was instituted and stabilized because it was a solution to this problem in the post-Civil War era. This was especially true in cotton agriculture. The solution to the labor extraction problem was sharecropping. The problem with sharecropping is that it requires a lot of coercion to maintain in place if it's to be profitable. And in particular, in order for sharecropping to be stable and profitable, you have to prevent coalitions with poor whites to prevent excessive labor migration to keep peasants on the land, very much like in feudal relations. Racialized sharecropping with political disenfranchisement was the solution to the problem of labor control over sharecropping. This is in contrast to the idea that the racialized state was simply the result of racial ideologies, of an intractable culture of racism generated by slavery. That Jim Crow was established because whites hated blacks and despised them as a social category, and it was simply an expression of Southern culture. What David James argues is that it was an expression of the Southern class structure. And thus, his view is it was superstructural. It had this organic superstructural relationship to the local conditions for the reproduction of class. The problem then is, in the 1950s, the racialized state comes under severe attack, and in the course of the 50s and 60s is destroyed. And he wants to answer two questions. Why was it that the racialized state could be destroyed in the 50s and 60s and not in the 20s or 10s? Why did it take so long? And second, how do we explain variation across the South in how easily the racial state collapsed, how easily it was challenged? So we wanted to look at variation across the South in the intensity of resistance to the civil rights movement, which was the resistance to the destruction of the racialized state. So the first historical question, why was this, did this state become so vulnerable in the 50s and 60s? He answers that by saying that by the 1950s, sharecropping had virtually disappeared in the South. That the New Deal and the response to the agrarian depression in the South in the New Deal was the end of sharecropping. That the federal government provided all sorts of subsidies to agriculture, but they went to the landowners, not to the workers who tilled the field. And they created huge incentives for landowners to displace sharecroppers from the land and to mechanize agriculture. So Southern agriculture becomes mechanized, starting in the 1930s, accelerating in the 40s during the war, as a response to and made possible by the agricultural subsidies. It becomes profitable for landowners to take land completely out of production. They're paid not to grow. The resources they get from being paid not to grow things, they use to mechanize agriculture, so that the remaining agricultural production they do is no longer done under sharecropping. It's done with hired labor. So migrant labor becomes an important form in the South, which it hadn't been before, because of the end of sharecropping. So by the 1950s, then, this coercive form of agrarian extraction is no longer part of the class structure, and therefore the class basis for the racial state no longer has that superstructural function, and therefore it becomes more vulnerable. It's not so important. The second part of the argument, then, is, well, if that's true, one would expect that those parts of the South that still had some sharecropping would be the parts of the South where there'd be the strongest resistance to the change in racial rules. And those parts of the South that had a long history of sharecropping, even if sharecropping wasn't so important any longer, would have a moderately strong resistance to the civil rights movement. But those parts of the South with no history of sharecropping, desegregation should have gone much smoother. His measure of this was the following. So how can you possibly study this, the degree of resistance? His strategy was to look at the rate of convergence of white and black voter registration rates by county, on the grounds that the mobilization for voter registration was so widespread in the South that a slower rate of convergence would indicate micro-level resistance of local authority, which they were able to do because the racialized state was more deeply entrenched in the local social structure. So he ran basically regressions of the rate of convergence of white and black voter registration rates across the counties of the state. And the predictor variables were various measures of the historical legacy of sharecropping, what percentage of the employment in the state was sharecropping or of the cropland was under sharecropping in 1920 and in 1950, so the few places where it still existed. And then he controlled for the percentage of the black population because, of course, sharecropping also would correspond to the black belt in the South. And what he showed was that even net of the percentage of black population, there was a strong effect of sharecropping, a negative effect, on the rate of convergence of black and white voter registration laws. I think it's a fantastically good piece of research to show that the racial state was not simply the product of a culture of racism, that was simply a kind of path-dependent holdover from the 200 years of slavery that had consolidated that cultural form in the South, but that it was also deeply connected to the functions that the racial state played for the underlying class structure, which is really a base superstructure argument at the local and regional level. Okay, it is noon. We will begin class formation on Wednesday.